Today on KPR Presents, Carly Fiorina, the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, the first woman to lead a Fortune 500 company, and in 2016, a presidential candidate. I'm Kay McIntyre. Carly Fiorina gave the annual Dole Lecture on April 14, 2019, moderated by Bill Lacey, the director of the University of Kansas Dole Institute of Politics.
Well, welcome, Carly, to KU and the Dole Institute of Politics. We're delighted to have you here.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, and I was recently with Senator Dole. He was a guest on my podcast, which is called By Example, and I was hugely relieved when he asked me, are you speaking at the Dole Institute, that I could say yes. The rest of the podcast went better, I think, as a result.
I'm sure that's the case. Well, let's start by getting to know you a little bit better. Tell us about your upbringing, your education, and how you decided to get into the business world.
Well, my, like so many of us, my mother and father provided an incredibly important foundation for me. Both of them had difficulties growing up, I would say. My mother was the only child of an assembly line worker in Ohio, and although she graduated as the valedictorian of her high school class, her father refused to let her go to college. He thought it was a waste. And so she ran away and joined the Women's Air Corps in Texas, which is where she met my father. My father had grown up in a very small town in Texas with a noticeable physical deformity and sort of powered his way through by dint of hard work and intellect. And I tell you those very brief stories about my mother and father because what they both instilled in me was the importance of an education, the importance of honor and integrity, the importance of making the most of your gifts. And in fact, they sort of summed it up when my mother said to me in Sunday school one day, what you are is God's gift to you. What you make of yourself is your gift to God. And it was sort of a promise to me that I had gifts, and I didn't feel very gifted, and it was a challenge that I needed to find them and use them. And that was very important. I was a goody-two-shoes middle child. My core competence was pleasing my parents and ticking off my older sister and younger brother. And so I didn't feel very gifted. And I went off to college. I went to a wonderful school, Stanford University, but I got a degree in medieval history and philosophy. I would actually highly recommend liberal arts. I think they're incredibly important, but I was unemployable. And so I tried law school. My dad wanted me to go to law school. I hated it, quit after less than a semester. I did have the presence of mind to go before the first exam, but I had no plan. I mean, literally no plan. And that's how I ended up as a secretary in a real estate firm. I had helped put myself through college as what we used to call a Kelly girl. We don't call them that anymore, but we used to be Kelly girls. I see so many women nodding knowingly. We were temporary office personnel, and I knew how to type and file and answer phones. So I went to work doing that full time. And what got me into business, that long convoluted story, is two men came up to my desk one day. They worked in that 9-person real estate firm. And they said, we've been watching you. We think you can do more than type and file. Do you want to know what we do? And that was my introduction to business. But more than that, I had this feeling that someone had seen possibilities in me that I didn't see in myself. And when someone sees possibilities in you, things change. And so I've tried never to forget that, because everyone, all of us, need somebody to take a chance on us, and I've had a lot of people take a chance on me.
Mm-hmm. You had to make some very tough calls as the CEO of Hewlett-Packard. Could you talk a little bit about that and describe how you were able to work with the stakeholders in those situations?
So, yes, a lot of tough decisions were necessary. When I was asked to become the CEO, The company was in great difficulty, actually. It was a storied company. It was a legendary company. It was a successful company. But it had sort of lost its way. And in the middle of the biggest technology boom in history, actually, it was growing at a little over 1%. Profitability was deteriorating in every product line. We were losing market share. We weren't number one anywhere anymore except for printing. We no longer were in the top 25 innovators in the world, even though we spent hundreds of millions of dollars every year on innovation. We had missed 9 quarters in a row, which is hard to do when you're a big company because there's a lot of, you know, jerry-rigging of a balance sheet that companies can do if they're not ethical. So a lot of transformation was required. And yet, this was a company that was very proud of its heritage and very proud of its culture. There was something called the HP Way, which was about the core values that the founders of the company, Bill and Dave, had focused on. Things like innovation, risk-taking, teamwork, integrity, serving customers. But over time, what had happened is people just shorthanded all that and talked about the HP Way. And the HP Way, that phrase, came to be a shield against change. We don't do it that way. It's not the HP Way. Now, I start with all that because, honestly, the first thing that was necessary was to reacquaint ourselves with who we really were and what we were really trying to do. And in order to do that, I asked a team of people to go out and speak with customers and partners. And for our customers and our partners to hold the mirror up to our face and show us what they saw. And what they told us was that we were slow, fat, complicated, pricey, that we weren't innovating anymore. The reason that was so important is because I was not going to be able to successfully catalyze change, which was necessary, by just saying, I'm the new CEO, things are going to change. People had to understand here and understand in their hearts as well why change was necessary. And the best people to tell them that was not their boss. The best people to tell them that were our customers, because people at HP wanted to serve customers and they wanted to be good partners. And so that's how we started. And once we had we spent a lot of time coming together as a team on all the assets we had, all the issues we had. It's what I call, when I teach problem solving to others, you have to have a clear-eyed and compelling and complete view of the current state. Where are we actually? And that's how our customers could help us. And then you have to have an aligned view of where do we want to go? What's the future state? And so we worked very hard on getting both of those things and then building a plan through consensus, actually, on what it would take to get there.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us why you wrote this book?
I wrote this book, Find Your Way. I wrote this book because I think there are a lot of people in this country who are feeling powerless, helpless, frustrated, perhaps because the culture around us lifts up a lot of things that are superficial, not substantive. We lift up power and fame, not leadership. We lift up outrage and controversy, not character. What I know from experience is that everybody has more potential than they realize. What I know from experience is that everyone can learn how to solve the problems that impact them. What I know from experience is people closest to the problem actually know best how to solve it. And what I also know from experience is that leadership is not about position or title. It is about changing the order of things for the better, and we are all capable of it. And so this book is about everything I know about leadership and why I know that everyone is capable of being a leader, whether they have a title or not, and that everyone is capable of the disciplines that all leaders possess, which are human qualities.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the difference between planning your life and having a path for your life.
So there are a lot of young people today. Maybe there's some here. And I was this way when I was in college. But I think there's huge pressure today on people to have it all figured out. And people get asked all these questions all the time. Well, where's your first job? And what are you going to do then? And where are you going to college? Just this constant set of questions that give the impression that everybody needs to have a pretty clear plan for their life. I had a clear plan for my life. I was going to go to law school. And then it all blew up. And after I quit law school and went to work in a 9-person real estate firm, people kept saying, especially my parents, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What's the plan? And my answer was, I don't know. I don't know. But I have to make a living. I have seen more careers derailed because somebody got so fixated on, I need to be a VP by this time. I need to make this much money by this time. I need to be in this kind of job by this point. I have seen so many people get derailed because they get so hung up on the plan that they don't see all the opportunities that are in front of them, or they don't actually use all of their potential and all of their gifts, and they never actually find out what they're made of. I've also seen people who have sacrificed virtually everything to achieve the plan, and when they actually get there to whatever their destination was, a couple things usually happen. Either they're so corroded by the journey to arrive at their destination that they're not who they once were or who they actually want to be anymore, or they get to the destination and they figure out it's not everything I thought it would be and they're disappointed or disillusioned, or they never get there at all and they're devastated. And so what I've seen people who are fulfilled and successful do over and over again is, how do I want to behave every day? How do I make sure that I see the opportunities in front of me, especially the opportunities to work with other people to make things better, solve a problem that's right in front of me? And what I know is opportunity always knocks. And if people are brave enough, they can walk through the door. And then other opportunities will come along. So my advice to young people, and we have a lot here, you didn't ask this, but their parents might be wondering. My advice, it's really simple. Get a job. Any job. It actually doesn't matter what job. It doesn't have to be the perfect job. Don't be disappointed if you don't get the perfect job or the one you hope for. Just get a job and do it really well. And when you do it well, you're going to learn a lot about yourself and a lot about other people, and opportunity will knock.
Okay, in the book you talk about the disciplines of leadership. What are some of those?
Well, you know, this is why I had Bob Dole on my podcast. I have a podcast called By Example, and I started that podcast for the same reason I wrote this book in many ways. I think people are very confused about leadership. I think they think it's somebody with a big title, someone with a big position. I used to think that. If you have a big office, you must be a leader. If you're famous, you have power, you must be a leader. There are leaders who have positions and titles, but they're not leaders because of their position and title. By example is to lift up people, some of them famous, some of them not, who are leaders because of their disciplines, not their titles. And Bob Dole is such a perfect example of this. So there are 4 essential disciplines that every leader, I think, must have if they're truly a leader, changing the order of things for the better and solving problems. The first is courage. And the reason courage is so important, and you know so many examples of Bob Dole's courage, but the reason courage is so important is because when you solve problems, you have to challenge the way things are. And when you challenge the way things are, people criticize you. And the reason they criticize you is because the status quo is powerful. Even when it's terrible, the status quo is powerful. So you have to be brave enough to challenge the way things are to make things better, and that takes courage. And Bob Dole has demonstrated that over and over again. It takes character. He certainly has that. Character is honor and integrity over time. It is courage over time. It is continuing to keep going when the going gets tough, And the going always gets tough. That's part of life, but it's certainly part of problem solving. It's collaboration. Bob Dole was a senator, and before that in his political career, a person of strong conviction, but he always was able to collaborate with people who didn't always agree with him. And the reason he could collaborate, which you have to do to solve problems, is because he was humble enough to know, I need other people. Maybe I need another point of view here. Maybe I need somebody who knows something I don't know. And he was also empathetic. He's so empathetic. It's amazing to hear him. I'm sure you have. But when Senator Dole talks about the veterans that he greets at the World War II Memorial, empathy just oozes out of his pores. And that empathy allows him to see value in other people, regardless of their appearance or their circumstances. And that's vital to leadership. And the last quality is, you can call it optimism, you can call it seeing possibilities, but leaders are people who see possibilities. No matter how bad a situation is, a leader sees the possibility for it to be better. And in particular, a leader sees possibilities in other people. And boy, is that Bob Dole. I mean, he talks about how optimistic he is. He talks about how he's so lucky. That's because he's one of these people who just sees possibilities everywhere he looks. Those are the fundamental qualities of leadership: courage, character, collaboration, seeing possibilities. And the reason I said anyone can lead is because those are human qualities. We all have them if we choose. And that's the hard part about leadership. In the end, it's about a choice. Because a lot of people could be brave and choose not to be. Or they could have character and they choose not to. They're choices.
Okay. What would you say to everybody about how they can go about maximizing their own potential?
Well, the advice that I give in the book, it's a little bit like the advice, get a job, any job. I have tools in the book, but I start with solve a problem. Any problem. Actually solve a problem. Because what happens is we all sit around and complain about problems, right? We all do. There's never a situation, if there are problems in any setting, a family, an institution, a club, a dorm, it doesn't matter where it is, a company, usually people know what they are, and they talk about what they are, and they complain about what they are. But it takes the catalyzation of leadership to actually do something about it. And so my advice is, pick a problem that you understand. Pick a problem that impacts you. Pick a problem that's close to you, in other words. Not big and abstract, close to you. And start working with others to solve it. And it's amazing what happens when people get focused on actually making something better. Usually everyone gets better.
You mentioned character a couple times. Talk a little bit about the importance of character in terms of leadership.
Well, you know, character, it's such an old-fashioned word in some ways, and we don't lift it up in our culture. Sometimes, you know, if you think about, I mean, I think it's very hard, all the stuff that's on social media, you know? Wow, the amount of time we spend in social media, and a lot of that stuff isn't about character, and it's not a solid foundation of values. But character is values over time. Character is knowing, for example, that the ends don't justify the means. Character is knowing that how you get things done is as important as what you get done. So in a company setting, yeah, it's important to make the quarterly numbers, but it's just as important, maybe more important over time, how you make the quarterly numbers. And how many times have we seen that play out in business? Those are all the aspects of character. And the reason that it is a discipline, it's easy to say, I have character. But of course, what happens is people's character gets tested. And I tell some stories in the book of where my character has been tested or other people's character has been tested. It gets tested because people get very fixated on the end, the goal, the destination, the prize. And so you'll hear, in some ways, I tell people the higher you go, the more temptations there are to sell out. The easier it is to let character go, the more likely it is that you're going to sell your soul. Politics, for example, George Washington told us in 1789, the trouble with political parties is they will come to care only about winning. Well, when winning is the goal, there are lots of times when we sacrifice character to win, and we've seen those stories. So hanging on to it, staying true to those values, when it's easier in the short run to let them go to achieve an end, and when sometimes letting them go to achieve that end gets you more accolades than standing true to character, it's easy to say and it's hard to do over time. Mm-hmm. That's why it's a discipline. Doesn't come easy.
You write in the book about the importance of people overcoming fears. Talk a little bit about that and how that helps one achieve their goals.
So one of the things that I've learned in my life is that everybody's afraid of something. And most of us are afraid of a lot of things, actually. There are what I would call profound fears. When I was diagnosed with cancer, that's a profound fear. I might die. When we realized that our younger daughter was an addict, that's a profound fear. She might die. But the truth is that we are so often paralyzed by fears that are not profound, but that nevertheless have tremendous power over us. I'm afraid of looking foolish. I'm afraid of making a mistake. I'm afraid of being criticized. I'm afraid I won't fit in. I'm afraid I'll never amount to anything. All these fears are debilitating to people over time. I'll tell you an interesting story to illustrate this. We do a lot of work through my foundation with the Wounded Warrior Project. And the people who are working with wounded warriors often talk about how difficult it is to get a wounded warrior to come to a job fair. And you would think, so many companies want to hire wounded warriors, and yet when they put on a job fair, they are always disappointed in who shows up. And so I was doing a leadership lab and some work with them, and I said, what are the veterans afraid of? People were startled by the question. These are wounded warriors. They're not afraid of anything. They've gone to battle. And a wounded warrior raised their hand and said, I'll tell you what we're afraid of. We're afraid of going and not being offered a job. We're afraid of being offered a job and not knowing how to do the job. We're afraid of going to the job and being pitied instead of being understood for what we can bring. All those are real fears, and we all have them. And the fear of being criticized is one of the most powerful fears people have. It's why the status quo is so powerful. Oh, don't rock the boat. Who do you think you are? That's not your job. Follow the process. Stick to the rules. And so we have to overcome those fears if we're going to actually make things better, which is the purpose of leadership. And frequently, we have to overcome criticism to lift someone up who we see has potential, but maybe doesn't fit the mold. I mean, what are you doing? They're hopeless. Well, no, actually they're not. It took a lot for those two men to come to my desk and say, we think you can do more. I'm sure they got criticized for that. So overcoming those fears that seem silly when we say them out loud, I'm afraid of making a mistake. But how many people don't move forward with something? Because they're afraid to make a mistake, or they're afraid to be criticized, or they're afraid to look foolish.
What advice do you have in the book for helping people improve their relationships with other people?
Well, I think Bob Dole, honestly, is such a great example of the how-tos here. But I talked about humility and empathy. Humility is required because, first of all, there's nothing worth doing that a single person can do all on their own. Nothing. I mean, we lift up the solitary hero, but they don't exist, really. Everyone who accomplishes anything is helped by others. Humility is knowing that. Humility is the ability to say, I don't know it all, I don't have it all, I can't do it all, I alone actually can't fix it. That humility is important because it's the impetus for a relationship in many cases. I learned that when I started out in business after I got out of the secretarial pool, I went into AT&T, I didn't know anything. I had to be humble. I literally didn't know anything. So I had to ask a lot of questions. And I found out that when you ask people questions, instead of telling them how much you know, you learn a lot. But not only do you learn a lot, but you start to establish a relationship. And then that hopefully can lead to empathy. And empathy is when you actually can see beyond someone's appearance, someone's circumstance, someone's political affiliation, someone's religious affiliation, whatever it is that makes them different from you, you can see past that and see or begin to understand what they bring to the table and why they are where they are and why they are who they are. So, humility, empathy, ask questions, ask questions, ask questions, and find something that together you can work on. Maybe a problem that impacts you both, or maybe something you both think could be made better.
What characteristics do you feel were most critical to you in terms of rising to, you know, being the CEO of Hewlett-Packard?
Well, honestly, I would say I think these qualities that I've talked about, I think it's kind of a package deal. Meaning, courage is the first one, but I think all of them are important. Let's just say quickly, a lot of people took a chance on me. We all need someone to take a chance on us. Every one of us needs that. I have too. And that means that people can see past, well, she doesn't look like what we think they're supposed to look like. So people took chances on me. But I think all of these things matter. My first client meeting when I went to AT&T, my first meeting where I was actually going to meet a real live customer was held in a strip club. Because my colleague and his clients always had lunch at a strip club when they came into town. And I might literally not have made it through my second week on the job if I had not been able to get over my fear of, oh my gosh, I've never been in a strip club. What am I going to do? I'm going to look like an idiot. Yep, I did. But I think all of those qualities are necessary. And I think besides all that, and this is true of all problem solving, whether you're a CEO or not, this ability to analyze what is the current state really, what is the current situation really, and find consensus about that, and then what are we trying to do really, what are we trying to accomplish, and can we agree on what we're trying to accomplish? I think that's vital as well. We so often in politics never even agree on the current state. We don't agree on what the problem is, so we're never going to solve it. And if we agree on the problem, we don't agree on the goal, and then we argue about the method to get from a point where we are, about which we disagree, and a point to which we're going, about which we disagree. It's no wonder we don't get anywhere.
What are some of the gender-based challenges that you face, both in the business world and in running for big political office?
Well, when you're different, it's different. When you're different, it's different. It just is. My first meeting was held in a strip club. When I became a CEO, all the press wanted to focus on my first day on the job, I wanted to talk about the company and innovation and all the wonderful assets we had. All they wanted to talk about was, oh my gosh, you're a woman. And the first in-depth interview that I gave, the editor of Business Week, which was then a very successful publication, I will admit I was delighted when they went out of business. I'm sorry, that's not kind of me, but the editor's question to me, very first question, was, what designer made your suit? So it's different when you're different. My campaign manager was routinely asked when I was running for president, what are those shoes she's wearing? So it's different when you're different, and we need to acknowledge that. The advice I give to young women or anyone who's different, honestly, is don't get a chip on your shoulder and don't hide your light under a bushel. And what I mean by that is when you're different than the norm, you're going to face different difficulties, sometimes more difficulties. And it's easy to get to the point where you think everybody is giving you a hard time. The guy in the strip club was giving me a hard time, and yet those two men who came to my desk gave me a hand up. And so there are truly bad people with bad behavior, and bad people and bad behavior has to be confronted. But most people aren't bad. They may be thoughtless, they may be careless, they may be clueless, but they're not bad people, and so you have to get over it. That guy who took me to the strip club, we became great colleagues, great teammates. And I learned later that he was afraid of me. He was afraid of the brand new model with the MBA who was going to take his job. So don't get a chip on your shoulder. And the other thing I say is don't hide your light under a bushel. It's tempting sometimes when you're getting a lot of flack for being different to try and fit in. When I was coming up in the business world, there was a book called How to Dress for Success. Right? Remember that? But then there was a book called How to Dress for Success for Women. And if you will recall that book, basically the advice was look as much like a man as possible. Wear a bow tie, wear a white shirt buttoned up. All the women are nodding their heads. Wear a white shirt buttoned up to the throat. Wear a very severe dark suit. Seriously. And we all kind of did that for a while. I was dressed that way going to the strip club, by the way. The cab driver did want to know if I was the new act, which just sort of added to the problem. A lot to take off, I think he figured. But the point is, we sort of strive to fit in sometimes. Don't. You know, don't, be who you are. Be who you are. Whoever you are, be that. Bring all of that to the table. Because when people try and fit in or do something they think somebody else wants, they're not living up to their potential, and they won't be as effective.
Okay, well, we've talked about your book pretty much, you know, since we started. I have to ask you this question.
This is kind of my life, actually.
Yes, but yes. I do have to ask you, though, this one question that's not related to the book. Give us your assessment of the current political scene.
Ah. Well, in a way, it's part of why I wrote the book. I do think that, first, there's a saying, politics is downstream of culture. And I think sometimes that's true. If you think about what our culture lifts up, what does our culture lift up? Reality TV, outrage, controversy, conflict. We lift up, I think, really, honestly, some of the stupidest, most outrageous people ever. We lift up people who are famous for being famous, right? And I think all that has sort of gone downstream to politics. But remembering George Washington, the trouble with political parties is they will come to care only about winning. I think we are at the point where politics is very much like our culture at large. It is a lot of vitriol, a lot of controversy. It's a little bit like worldwide wrestling. What's not happening is progress on festering problems. How long have we been arguing about immigration? How long have we been arguing about debts and deficits? How long have we been arguing about health care? How long have we been arguing about veterans care? For a really long time. And so part of me thinks that the purpose of the political system, to focus on winning, it makes it very difficult to solve problems. Because the dynamic of winning in sports, my team versus your team, you know, hey, it's my team. I don't care what my team does. It's my team. And we excuse people's character because they're on our team. We destroy people's character because they're not on our team. That dynamic is the opposite of problem solving. A problem solving dynamic is always, as Bob Dole demonstrated, the dynamic of problem solving is always win-win. Let me find the best in my opponent, not the worst. Let me try and find common ground, not polarize the situation. On the other hand, unresolved problems win elections. And so that's why so often we talk about the unresolved problem and we never somehow resolve it. You could add gun control to that. Pick your problem that we argue about. But the dynamic of problem solving is always win-win. It is always collaborative in a spirit of humility and empathy. I think we lack a lot of humility and empathy these days, and a lot of problems are festering.
I think a lot of people here would agree with you very much. I have one more question, then I'm going to open it up to Q&A from the audience. My final question, Carly, is about your organization, Unlocking Potential. What's the mission of the organization, and what do you hope to achieve over the next several years?
The mission of the organization is to bring leadership and problem-solving training to nonprofit organizations. There is, we do through Carly Fiorina Enterprises leadership and problem-solving training for corporations, for businesses of all sizes. But having led several nonprofits myself, there is a lack of investment in human capital in the nonprofit world. And frequently, that investment is lacking, not because people aren't good, it's that the money goes elsewhere. I want the money to go to the meal. I want the money to go to the clothing. I want the money to go to the child. And so often, people in nonprofits who are dealing with, if you think about it, some of the most pressing and festering problems in our society, the people aren't invested in. And so we have a national network of coaches and a curriculum that is very similar to this book, which is based on things that I know work because I've used them for so many years. And we deliver that to nonprofits of all kinds where we're invited. In some cases, we collaborate with companies who want us to help lift the nonprofits up that they invest in. But it's been very rewarding work, and I hope that we will continue to make a difference in the communities where we are invited.
That's Carly Fiorina giving the annual Dole Lecture at the University of Kansas. The former CEO of Hewlett-Packard will take questions from the audience at the Dole Institute of Politics right after this. From the University of Kansas, we're Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg Junction City. We're on the web at kansaspublicradio.org. If you missed last week's conversation about President Trump and the media, you can listen to it on our website, as well as most previous episodes of KPR Presents. You can also subscribe to the KPR Presents podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Support for KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio comes from Audio Reader, a radio reading service for the blind and visually impaired. Grateful for the generosity of all donors to help meet annual programming needs. Donation information is at reader.ku.edu. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, it's the 2019 Dole Lecture with former presidential candidate and former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina. She now takes questions from the audience at the Dole Institute of Politics.
We have a question right here from the Chancellor.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and your insights. What motivated you to run for political office, and what did you learn from running for political office?
So what motivated me is I think ours was intended to be a citizen government. I think we have too many professional politicians. And I think when you have been doing the same thing, running and winning, running and winning, running and winning, running and winning your entire career, there's a lot you don't know. Now, I think our country was founded on the principle that citizens go to serve for a while, and then they go away. go back to doing something else. I also think that from a skill point of view, I thought it was useful that somebody who understood bureaucracies really well would try and talk about what it takes to move a bureaucracy. The government is a huge bureaucracy. And one of the reasons it never changes is because I don't think we have enough people who understand actually how to change it. I'm not saying, by the way, that there aren't very fine people in politics. There are some really fine people in politics. But I am saying that I think there are too many people who have done nothing else. And that's not healthy in any situation. Diversity is good in many forms. What did I learn? I learned that the disconnect between what gets talked about in political campaigns and how it gets talked about and how it gets amplified through the media and what citizens and voters actually want to talk about, that distance is vast. And I think it's getting bigger. You know, I would sit and have conversations with voters and they would be so different than the conversations I would have on a debate stage or with the media. That's one thing I learned. The second thing I learned is that the two political parties control the process to a degree that we are not aware. I was not aware until I was in it. So the two political parties determine how the debate schedule works, who gets on the debate stage, how long you're on the debate stage, how long you get to talk on the debate stage, whether you make it to the debate stage. Those rules are set by the parties and the media before anything ever starts. And it's been true every election. I didn't know that. I thought debates were kind of an opportunity for citizens to take a look at everybody. They're actually not. They're pretty orchestrated processes, and they're orchestrated to get through primaries as fast as possible. Because if your purpose is winning, you want to get to a general election.
Okay, we have a question in the way in the back. Caitlin.
Thank you. I guess most of my question was regarding, it is true what you said, that things are different when you're different. I almost check every minority box in the, you know, in the book. But I guess it's a lot harder the more things change and the more people become aware of things like racism and misogyny and things like that, because it becomes something you don't talk about anymore. And then you have to rely on, yes, I'm gonna do my work the best I can, but believing in this non-existent meritocracy, whereas the system is already kind of rigged. So I guess, how do you go on and make positive difference and stay true to yourself, understanding that most of what the obstacles you're gonna face, you're never gonna get to actually see them or address them directly?
So, I think it is without a doubt true that there are structural obstacles. And I think it is also without a doubt true that, well, let me back up and give you some data. Because I believe in having a clear-eyed view of the current state. Where are we actually? So, on the one hand, you could say things have gotten so much better in terms of diversity. And they have in many ways. And yet, for example, if you looked at corporate boards, you would find percentage of women's about 16%, percentage of people of color or minorities is about 12%. Those numbers have not moved in 25 years. So we're not making as much progress as we should. And what that data tells us is there are structural impediments. And it also tells us that there are habits that get in the way. That's just true. A habit that gets in the way is human. We all share it. But for example, all of us are most comfortable with people like us. We're most comfortable with people that we have something in common with. It's hard for us to collaborate with people who are truly different. It's why humility and empathy are so important. And so what you see is groups of people over time becoming more and more and more alike. And you see so many selection criteria being based on who do I know? Am I comfortable with them? Are they like me? And so ultimately, we're going to make the kind of progress we need to make as a nation when we realize that our diversity is our strength. And if you have people who have a different point of view, that's a good thing. It's harder, but it's a good thing. So now to your specific question. I got asked a version of this question at another university, Catholic University, where I was speaking a couple weeks ago. And somebody said, how do you know when to just do your job and do it really well and quit because you can't stand it anymore, your values are being sacrificed, or how do you know which to do, stick to it or get out? And I said, well, there is something else. And I think this is the hard part. It's called confrontation. There is a time when bad behavior has to be confronted, and when attitudes that get in people's way have to be confronted. It's back to courage. The very first time I became a boss, and I had subordinates, and my boss introduced me to my new subordinates as, this is Carly, she's our token bimbo. Okay? Mm. Now, things have changed. Maybe we know not to say that, but things haven't changed so much. Sometimes people think that. And so I had a decision to make. Could I keep going, put my head down? Should I quit? What I chose was a third way. In that case, I said, I have to confront this. And so I went into his office and I closed the door and I said, you will never, ever do that to me again. And here's why. There is a point in time when you must respect yourself. And if you don't respect yourself, others will not respect you. And sometimes that takes you to a tough place. But it may be a better place than quitting altogether or just burying your head and pretending that you're unlocking your potential when in fact you're just miserable. And no one fulfills their potential when they're miserable.
Okay, we have a question over here.
It appears that you believe term limits could be one of the solutions to some of the governmental problems. What are the chances of ever getting term limits through a Congress of political long-term politicians?
Zero. Now, by the way, I'm not saying it could never happen, but if you think back, what is the genius of this country? What is the thing that is absolutely unique about this country? It's not that we're a democracy, actually. It's that citizens are sovereign. When, not government, not presidents, not senators, not citizens. This is a country, if you read the Constitution, of course, it talks about individual rights. Why? Because the individual was thought to be the center of power, sovereignty. We've had to work really hard to make sure the individual meant all individuals. But nevertheless, that was a unique idea. And the other thing, of course, the Constitution talks about is concentration of power. And how power concentrated is power abused. The Constitution is a lot about preventing the concentration and the abuse of power, and we've concentrated a whole lot of power in a bunch of people in one city called Washington, D.C. Alex de Tocqueville came to this country in 1830-something, and what he remarked upon was what he called civil society. What he found so remarkable about this country was not our institutions of government. It was not our politicians. It was civil society. The only way term limits are going to happen is if citizens demand it. And maybe it has to happen state by state. In a country like ours, problems get best solved bottom up, not top down. We know that. That's true in a business. It's true in our country. Not all countries, but in this country, it's clearly true. But if you think it's going to happen because people who are in Washington and want to stay there are going to say, hey, this is a good idea, let's vote on term limits, that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. It has to come from the bottom up.
Okay, we have a question here.
I was going to ask, with your presidential run, as well as the Trump administration and the influence, or I guess rather the candidacy of Howard Schultz, do you think there is a continued interest in corporate interest and corporate influence in presidential runs and politics in general, or is this just a weird blip?
Well, first let's say there's tons of corporate influence in politics, right? Through money, through, you know, one of the reasons I talked so much in my presidential run about the concentration of power is because a big, complicated, concentrated locus of power, which is what Washington is, it's big, it's complicated, there's a lot of power concentrated there, is in that kind of setting, only the big can influence, the wealthy. Big companies have a far better chance of influencing legislation than small companies ever do. Wealthy people have a better chance than poor people. I mean, it's how big, complicated systems work, unfortunately. And it's why dispersing that power, ultimately, I hope, we will get passionate about that as a nation, because we can't address so many other things as long as so much power is concentrated. If you're asking, do I think it's a blip that business people say, I'm going to run for president, I hope it's not a blip. I hope we have more and more citizens with diverse backgrounds who say, I'm going to actually get involved in politics, not forever, but for a time. It would be interesting. I know we have, in a place like Kansas, there are people who do farm, who also are in government. But the point is, a different point of view is important. That's not to say that the government is just like a business. It's clearly not. That's not to say that there aren't very specific things that someone has to learn or know about public policy, about three co-equal branches of government, about how things work. That's clearly true. But it is not healthy in a company to have everybody in charge be the same and have done nothing else but be in that company. It is also not healthy in a country for everybody in politics to be basically the same. And I think in many ways we're seeing the fruits of that. So I hope more people from different walks of life will get into politics. The question is, will they be captured by the system, or will they actually challenge the system? Not just to rattle the China, but to actually solve some problems. That is the question.
Okay, do we have any other questions?
Really appreciate you being here this afternoon.
Thank you. And congratulations.
Thank you very much. And so I just have an overall question. Given all that you've accomplished in your, you know, your business life, personal life, your professional life, what advice would you give yourself if you were 25 years old and starting over?
So we don't get a do-over, do we? But but what I would say to myself is, don't worry about all this stuff that we worry about. We worry about so much stuff that doesn't matter in the end. And it's very hard, because when you're young, you do want to fit in, and you do want to be popular, and wow, there's so much pressure now on social media. I mean, the amount of time some people spend curating the perfect photo on Instagram is wow. None of that matters. It doesn't matter. And so what I would say is, don't worry about the stuff that doesn't matter. Worry about the things that do matter. And the things that matter are all the things we've been talking about. Who am I really? What do I really want? Who do I really want to be? Someone, I had a student who asked me the other day, how would you define success? And we get all mixed up about success too. And I truly mean this, and I wouldn't have said it at 25. A successful person is a person whose life is filled with love, moments of grace, and positive contribution. And when people focus on those things, good things happen.
Okay, we have a question right here.
What became of the two men who saw potential in you?
Well, they became hugely successful. George Marcus and Bill Millichap, I am in touch with them to this day. From that little 9-person real estate firm, they eventually built, it's Marcus and Millichap, it's huge, it's regional, now national. They became hugely successful, which did not surprise me at all, because they taught me all that time ago, although I didn't know it at the time. If the purpose of leadership is problem solving, the highest calling of a leader is to unlock potential in others. The highest calling of a leader is to unlock potential in others, and they knew that. They saw possibilities in lots of people. And because they saw possibilities in lots of people, they built a really successful business.
Okay, we have a question over here.
Putting aside policy differences, who do you think best exemplifies leadership in the 2020 Democratic field?
Man, I'm not answering that one. I mean, good try. And I'll tell you why I'm not answering. I'm not just punting to be politically correct. The reason I'm punting is that, you know, there's that old saying, tough times build character. I actually think tough times reveal character. So, they're all going to have some tough times. Let us see what character is revealed.
Okay, you get the final question here today.
Oh, boy. My question is, you said that you learned a lot that you didn't know when you ran for office. So if you were to do it again, what would you do differently based on what you learned? And will we see Carly Fiorina on the ballot again?
Well, first of all, I've learned never say never, but it's not my focus now. I would also tell you that just as I never had a plan to become a CEO, and I truly didn't, I never had a plan to run for president. And then as time went on, it became the right decision for me, given the opportunities I saw. What would I do differently? I think the answer is I'm not quite sure, but what I know is that I know a lot more now about how the system works. And that's useful because we don't know. I didn't know how the system worked. I didn't know how the debate system worked. Now I do. And I feel for those 18 Democrat candidates because they're entering into a system that is designed to wean them really fast and designed to choke oxygen off of a lot of them as fast as possible. So knowing that, I'd have to think about your question, honestly, but just knowing that would cause me to look at it differently.
This would be a great place for an announcement about 2020 or 24, 2024
No.
If you want to make one. Listen, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful afternoon.
You've been listening to Carly Fiorina, the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, the first woman to lead a Fortune 500 company, and 2016 presidential candidate. Fiorina gave the annual Dole Lecture on April 14, 2019 at the University of Kansas, moderated by Bill Lacey, director of the Dole Institute of Politics. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.